Xin chào mừng mọi người đến với Have a Sip Uống Gì Không, một chương trình mà rất là nhiều tập Thùy Minh giới thiệu khách mời của mình là những người nhiều chữ. Sau đó thì cái chữ nhiều chữ này nó luôn luôn gợn gợn suy nghĩ của khán giả là thế nào là nhiều chữ. Nó xuất phát điểm từ việc là những cái người xuất bản những cái cuốn sách, đúng không? Và nó theo cái nghĩa đen là có rất là nhiều chữ ở trong đấy. Sau này thì mình thấy là các cái câu chuyện của mình nó dần thiên về những người tạo ra nội dung. Và đến cái thời điểm này, năm thứ tư của Have a Sip ấy, thì bắt đầu thì mình nghĩ về việc là mình rất là hứng thú với những người kể chuyện. Bản thân chúng ta ai cũng có một câu chuyện, nhưng mà một số người ấy, thì họ không chỉ kể câu chuyện của cuộc đời họ, cá nhân họ, mà họ còn có cả một cái công cụ, một cái hệ công cụ để kể câu chuyện của người khác. Hôm nay xin được chào mừng lần đầu tiên đến với Have a Sip một người bạn cũng rất là thân của Thùy Minh, một người mà đã từng là Thùy Minh đến New York ở nhờ nhà. Và cái cuộc trò chuyện của chúng tôi sẽ diễn ra bằng tiếng Anh, nhưng mà lời chào thì xin được chào Bảo Nguyễn.
Ok, xin chào Thùy Minh. That's the only Vietnamese I'm gonna say, maybe.
Not the only.
Maybe a little later.
The very first interview that I interviewed you when I was, I think, similar hair, like more Afro, for Yan TV, when you just done Saigon Yo, and then the rapping party, and then I asked Bảo Nguyễn, and Bảo Nguyễn still remember that line. Hỏi Bảo Nguyễn là làm phim ở Việt Nam thấy thế nào? And Bảo Nguyễn trả lời là
Nóng quá. Still the same answer.
So Bảo, not just a good friend of mine, but how I describe you, because I've seen you from that moment to now, and then I just rewatched some interview that you done 11 years ago when Julian, the movie, I haven't seen that one, came out. You changed so much and your projects getting bigger and bigger. And now you're in Vietnam because you're the jury of the Ho Chi Minh City International Film Festival.
Well, I hope I haven't changed too much, or if I change, it's for the better. Mm-hmm. I never watch old interviews of myself because it's just a weird experience. And I guess we all grow and we all change. I mm-hmm. think the same knowing you in a very different stage of your life. When not that you were just like staying at my place in New York, but asking to borrow my credit cards.
Oh my God, Val.
Well, we're allowed to talk about anything, right? Maybe I shouldn't set the tone, and now you're going to ask me other things about myself. But it's been over 10 years, maybe 12 years, I mm-hmm. suppose, mm-hmm. we first met. And I was a different person, very bright-eyed, young, coming to Vietnam with not knowing a lot of things. I mean, still not knowing a lot of things. Actually, I think I thought I knew a lot of things when I came here. And in the process of growing up, you sort of let go of thinking you know anything. I think that's one experience I've noticed in the past 12 years, mm-hmm. and sort of like surrendering yourself to the mm-hmm. things you don't know. But it's always great coming back to Saigon. And for this particular occasion, it's very special because it's the first ever international film festival held in Ho Chi Minh City, which is a big surprise to me.
Right. So Bao is nominated for the Emmy Award for the documentary Beat Water to be the jury, which is gonna give nominations and awards to people. Is that, I don't know, in the film industry, is that a change, like a such a different role to?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a different role, but I think because like usually these awards and juries are comprised of colleagues, like other filmmakers, actors and actresses, people who hopefully watch film still. I'm quite honored and privileged to, especially this is the first one, because I know the process from the other side of like having a film that is being selected and being judged. And I always hope that from the other side, the judges, the jurors are like very careful and mm-hmm. mindful of all the hard work it takes to make a film. Even, you know, films that I might not enjoy, I respect how hard it is to make. Mm. And so I make sure I watch every single film, taking notes and watching. It's nice because I, especially this festival, I'm on the jury for the Southeast Asia films. And a lot of the times I would be watching the same films, like go watch Dune 2 or something, or all the, you know, a Marvel film for past lives. But now it's been selected for me to like watch these, you know, 11 films from Southeast Asia that I wouldn't usually go watch, and to see the different types of films being made. They're all very different, eclectic. And as someone who loves cinema, it's just like a nice surprise. Mm-hmm. Like going to a concert that maybe your friend recommends and tells you you will love this concert and not knowing anything, and just coming out and, again, being surprised.
Because you work in Vietnam, like, and then you even found a production house here, the East Film. Does it change a lot, the way people making film these days, or the taste or the technique? It's like, has it been changing a lot?
I mean, film is still such a very, you know, young art form, like just, you know, over 100 years. If you think about like writing and painting, even photography, it's much longer. There are still like different languages of film that are being created. And I think in Vietnam, I mean, since the internet, I think has changed how youth culture can experience film. I think the best film school is just watching films and then hopefully making films with your friends, being able to fail. And what, you know, I've been able to produce two feature films here, and I just noticed like the type of spirit of filmmaking here is different from Hollywood, where I live now. And I always respect like the hunger and the idea of, in Vietnam, in any industry, if there's a will, there's a way. if you can do it, like you find a way to do it. And you know, in the U.S., there's a lot of things you cannot do. And so I hope like to take that spirit. I hope filmmakers here, young filmmakers, carry that spirit even as the film industry progresses and gets more expensive and more sophisticated. That all filmmakers, not just in Vietnam but all around the world, hold on to that independent spirit.
You work in two different market industry, and you travel the world. Do you find struggle making movie here or there?
There's struggles everywhere you make films. It's hard to compare anything. It's like, this may feel random, but now I live in Los Angeles, but I lived in New York for a long time, and everyone's like, oh, what city do you like better, New York or Los Angeles? And they're so different. They each have their own qualities. And if I was to compare it, I think I'd set myself, I live in Los Angeles now. If I say I love New York, it, you know, it feels weird. There's a reason that I'm in Los Angeles. So when I'm making a project here, there's a reason that I approach it differently. I don't really approach it the same way. You know, working here for 12 years, I know the culture is different. I think sometimes when, you know, foreigners, you know, I was born in the U.S., they come into a new place and they assume that everything that they learn from the other place that they grew up in, and they assume that everyone else speaks that same language in a way, is quite disrespectful to the local cultures and customs. It's my duty as someone coming in from the outside to change and think about that and learn, really. I think that's the beauty of when I worked in Vietnam, is learning like there's not one way to make film. There's principles and traditions that have made films a certain way for you know, almost for over a century, but it's always changing, and that's what keeps it exciting. If you're doing the same thing over and over again, then it's not very fun. It's funny, I was at Sundance Film Festival early this year, premiering my film, and there was a documentary. It's sort of made by AI. It's about Brian Eno, who's a famous music producer, and he's quite experimental, and no version of the film is the same as the previous version. They hook up the software into like the computer that plays it, or the projector. The beginning and the end of the film is always the same, but the middle will always change. And so the director is like, you know, for a musician, even if they play the same song, it's never going to be exactly the same way. And like, he was tired of watching his films and having the same experience, which I understand. I don't totally agree with him, because I think even though the film changes, doesn't change, you as a person change. And so when you watch it, then you have a different experience. But for the case of this film, it's like everything is changing. Again, learning bringing new innovations to filmmaking. I think with the festival, hopefully like other filmmakers in Vietnam who don't have a chance to really go and see foreign films, there's a lot of, you know, more independent stories and films that are showing here, international films. And they can just see like what types of films are being made. That's always my favorite part of a film festival.
Mm-hmm. You say it's hard to compare, but we always just compare. It's, I think for you, I don't know if you have any conflict of like being American and Vietnamese at the same time, working in Vietnam and working in Hollywood. But like you say, depend on the time of your life, you were looking for a different, you know, experience. But I still want to go back to my questions about, if we look at the bright side, what's the best thing to happen when you're making a movie here? And what's the best thing happen when you're making a movie over there?
Yeah, I mean, making a movie here, it's, in many ways, the risk is lower because it's...
Yeah?
In some ways, I think the risk of monetary risks, right? It's more inexpensive to make a film here, obviously, compared to Los Angeles.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, there's less...
But making movie here, it's already considered, it's like you only have a... You only do it if you have a big budget, right? Compared to other...
It's hard because I think Vietnam is in a transition. When I first moved here, you know, 2012, 2011, maybe like 12 local films were being screened in cinemas. And now it's like maybe 70, 80. Yeah. It's crazy. But there's a certain expectation of the quality, I think, too, which is good. I think that's important. You know, there's a film like Rom that I worked on. That film would be very hard to make in America with the same amount of money. Mm-hmm. Even if you were to think like of inflation and, and currency conversion and all that, it's just like the way that they made the film, they would have been arrested in America, maybe. Like, you're just shooting, you know, the rules are different. There's a way around things. I think it's the type of thinking that in Hollywood nowadays is like, you try to do something, you hit something, you don't think a way around it. You just stop. You keep on going, you're pressing against something. Here, it's like you'll go around it and around and around and around. And I think that actually helps creativity, thinking about how you can move around a certain obstacle. And I think that's just the mentality. I don't want to speak too generally about Vietnamese culture, but what I found is that in the sense of like artists, they're always looking for the way around things. There's different types of industries where if no means no and people stop. But I think with artists, and it's a part of just being that type of person that wants to do art and be creative. I mean, the term creative means like to find some new path around something.
Adaptable, flexible.
Exactly. So that's my favorite part about shooting in Vietnam. In the U.S., especially in a place like Los Angeles, which I never thought I would end up there. I'm always just an East Coaster.
See, you know, you prefer New York better.
Again, at this moment, let me tell you why I love Los Angeles, though. Because Los Angeles is a city where almost everyone has come for a dream, right? Like, it's a city that you come to make movies, to be an actor, to be an actress. No one would tell you that's a right way to live your life. It's a very risky way. So most of the people who've come there have taken a risk. And so that's a beautiful part of Los Angeles that people don't think about. Like, even if they're working as a waiter or even like a lawyer, they're like, well, I came here because I wanted to write movies or I wanted to act in movies. And so I think that's something that is very unique about Los Angeles. And you're surrounded by people who love film. Like, they will tell you what their favorite film is. And we talk about film all the time. And it's that, as someone who obviously works, not just works in that industry, but like loves that art form, it's inspiring. Yeah.
And let's go to your newest projects, The Greatest Night and Pop. How much is the budget?
How much is the budget? And you can't answer. I can't answer that question.
Really? Is that something?
It's yeah. That you can't. It's you're not.
Okay. Fine. You know, sometimes people guess. It's like people can make a guess.
You can spend the whole interview talking about how much.
You know, how much you like that project.
How much do I like it? I love that project.
Yeah.
But it's funny. I don't think if you talked to me 3 years ago and you asked me, oh, what are you working on next or what do you want to work on? Mm-hmm. And I'd say, oh, I would really want to do a film about We Are the mm-hmm. World. Because I was only 2 years old when the song came out.
Yeah, same. And,
yeah, we're the same age. You're a little older than me. But I was very young when the song came out. Obviously, I know the song, but I didn't know how big the song was when it came out. It's funny, the reason I did the film actually started in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you the story now. Whenever I'm approached with a project, I always ask, am I the right person to tell the story? Do I want to tell the story? What is my approach to the story? With We Are the World, it was like, can you make a whole film about one song? Mm-hmm. It's very hard. There's not been many films that have done that well. Am I going to shoot myself in the head having to listen to We Are the World over and over and over again? Luckily, the film is like very much about the making of and the mm-hmm, process, mm-hmm. so you don't really hear it till the very end. And yeah, how am I going to make this an interesting film? My producer, Julia Nottingham, who I did Be Water with, she was, this is like in the pandemic, and we were thinking like what project we wanted to work on next. And, you know, in the U.S., it was very hard to shoot at that time. So we're like, okay, let's find a film where there's a lot of footage and maybe we can create a film out of old footage. And then that's when she asked me if I knew the song We're the World. And she gave me some articles in the book, and I read about the story and how it was very interesting to make it all in one night. And I thought, okay, this is a very interesting story. It's maybe, you know, beyond just the song. If I can make a film for people who maybe don't like the song, but they appreciate it through the story, then that's sort of my role as a filmmaker, as a director. When I read the story, I was like, oh my God, there's like so much tension in the story. It happened in one night. It felt like Ocean's 11, maybe. Mm-hmm. It's just like a heist film. Like there's all this, the best people come together to do something very impossible. But I was still, at the time, I was like, okay, there's all these things telling me yes, but I still don't feel perfectly right for this project. And I was coming back to Vietnam to visit my family, still lives here. And I remember getting into like a Vinasun or something, or Mylan. The cab driver, he was like, maybe like, sound me by Meet the Way, couldn't speak any English. And he put on a mix CD. Mm-hmm. And then the first song is We Are the World. Mm-hmm. And so I was just like, okay, that's a sign.
Wow.
Yeah. So I guess the song is very big in Vietnam.
At that time, right? It's like Vietnam is like in delay mode, like not everything come out and then just come to Vietnam right away. It take years to actually be delivered. So I actually, it's so popular for me because it's like, you know, like let's say the 90s something that you start listening to the song. I recommend people to watch the film because we watch it and it's really enjoy the whole movie itself, and then you would be surprised how just the process of making. But there's like 46 music legends that, you know, it's like an Ocean 11 kind of, there's a height that have to do. What would you do different if you watch it all? Would you change?
I mean, to be honest, like as an artist, a filmmaker, I try not to think about what I would do differently because I tend not to watch my films too much after. Mm-hmm. It depends on, maybe I'll watch it with a different audience and I'm more interested in their reaction than what is there. Like Ocean Vuong says something really important about art, that when you create something, it's like you're creating a raft, right? And then you're like setting it off onto the river and you can't pull it back. And that's how I feel with a lot of the work that I do. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, again, you change as a person. So I think like, okay, this is Dao Ying Bao Wing at this time made this film, and that's
and he's already evolved to some different version.
Yeah, and so I think it's very stressful to think like how you can constantly change it. You hope that the world receives it in a way that you intended, and I've been like very lucky with this film. It was like number one in 12 countries on Netflix. So it was number one in the world, right? Globally, which is crazy for a documentary, to be honest. Netflix was telling me all this. And then top 10 in 80 countries. And so there's not many films and projects that are that global. And I was very surprised, again, because the song to me, I mean, I knew it was a big song, but I had so many people reach out to me and say like how you know, they're crying watching the film. Some of my favorite directors, like Barry Jenkins, who directed Moonlight, and like Steven Spielberg, and like Joel Cohen, all these directors I really love told me like how much they love the film. Mm-hmm. And so then I'm like, I won't change anything. You get that reception, and you know people receive it in a way. And mm-hmm. I think when you let the raft in the boat go, it's not about you anymore. It's about the audience. And you know, I think some filmmakers too. And I think when I was younger, I'll go off on a slightly different subject. But when I was younger, I always thought, okay, I'm just going to make films, and I don't really care how many people watch it or the reception, which I think is important. I still make films thinking like, will I want to watch it? And that's the only judge that you can determine is yourself. Mm-hmm. But when people watch it, then it's cinema. Cinema is different from a motion picture. Cinema is you create a motion picture that there's an audience for. That's like, that's a distinction in the term between cinema and moving pictures. And so I want cinema where there's an audience and that can relate to that and that can connect to it. And I've been, again, like having all these messages from around the world and people from Vietnam too. Mm-hmm. It's really heartwarming. And it's on Netflix in Vietnam, and you can watch it dubbed or subtitled in Vietnamese. And now my mom can finally watch it in Vietnamese, which is nice because she never really knew what I did. And now that she's a big Lionel Richie fan. And so now she's been able to watch it. That means a lot. And I think having a viewer connect to it means a lot. And I don't think about how I would change it anymore. And that's why I can't watch it. I think if I watched it, I would be thinking about all these things. But again, I've let it go.
So let's say you did not foresee that it's going to be that big. But when you make movie, do you have the feeling that, you know, this is something that, you know, it changed you and it will change the audience?
I don't know if I have that feeling when I'm making it. It's just, I'm just trying to enjoy the process of it as much as possible. Because if I thinking about the expectation and the outcome, that's quite stressful. And it's something that I can't control is the outcome. Directors are control freaks. And so the things that I can't control is like what I'm doing today, when I'm editing, when I'm shooting, when I'm directing. But I can't control what Bao 30 days later will watch and react. I just know that if I've put in all of my hard work into the process, then I can say once it's finished that I left it all. In America, they have this term, you leave it all in the field, right? You don't hold anything back. I know that this is all I could have done. I did my best. And hopefully, again, people will react to it. But if I'm thinking like, oh, will this person laugh at this line? Like, is this like good enough? Like, you're always going to be not satisfied in many ways. When you finally show it for the first time, that's when you're very nervous, like to a group of strangers, because you don't know how people will react once you're done. Once you created the boat in a way. And so that's when the first viewing is always like, because especially when you make something that has jokes, or that's a very easy way to determine whether people are going to like it if they start laughing. And I remember the first time we screened the film to an audience, people are laughing at parts that I didn't intend for them to laugh at, which is good because I just want people to have fun. I want people to be joyful watching this film. It's a film that was made during the pandemic, and it's meant for people to feel like the power of music and feel like they can be Bob Dylan, they can be Michael Jackson. It's all, you know, a mutual friend of ours, Viet Max, is a very big Michael Jackson fan, and he told me how much he loved the film. And I'm always thinking about like the people who really love these artists and love these songs and like how they react to it when it's done. I don't think about it when I'm making it because I can't predict that.
I ask that question because I don't know, as a writer and then try to publish books, I always waiting for the feeling of like, this is my final book, you know, like maybe it's not my main job. But like I always wait for that feeling to come. And then I didn't have that so often. But with the books that hasn't come out yet, I have that feeling. I'm like, oh, I always want to wait for this. It's not supposed to be very pleasant at all. But I know that, oh, okay, I can totally stop writing book after this one. Like, I don't need to dream more, make more anymore. So that's why I wonder about that feeling. That is that. Is
okay, that, before you ask me a question, I'm curious because, like, I think, does that mean you don't, you've lost the passion to write books then? Like, if you're waiting for the last one, I feel like you're not enjoying the process anymore. There's a thing called arrival fallacy where they say, like, oh, I will be happy when I finish my 10th book, or I will be happy when I buy that nice car. And then once you buy that nice car, you finish that book and you're not happy, then it's called the fallacy, right? And so I always think, like, no, I'm happy writing in the process of it. Again, like, I try to be in the process of things and let that, again, like a very Buddhist present moment type of thinking. But I'm curious, like, does that mean, like, are you trying to move on to your next thing? You want to get into, like, architecture or something? And is this just, like, a chapter in your life that you want to finish?
No. I think writing, it's everything. Like, I'm talking to you right now as I'm writing, you know. It's just that, same. I would never know in 30 days the Twin Ming version will be. But then I know at this moment, this is what I feel like, okay, I can be done anytime, right? It doesn't mean that I will stop it, but I feel like, oh, the feeling of this one is this here. It's like really like, that's it. So, yeah.
It's because you actually like that project so much that you feel like you can't tell anymore after that?
For me, it's like, so that's why I know that we're a very different person, right? I think I'm more extreme. Bao is more gentle people. But then I feel like I pull something and it's so painful that I don't think I can do it again. It's too much effort of that.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you go and look back any project, I don't know if it's happened to you yet. The pain of, like, you have to, because I interview a bunch of someone like Chen Eng Hong, you can feel the pain. But, you know, I don't know about you. Like, maybe it's not even your goal, ultimate goal at all, but is there any project that you feel that you actually pull some, or it's every time?
I mean, it might be that Tay Lin thing that I did.
Oh, yeah. Bao did the, what's the name of the song? The newest songs of the Ling with Apple. What's
Don't make it complicated.
Well, đừng làm nó phức tạp. Trong tiếng Việt. Yeah. Yeah. Wow, she said the same thing.
That project?
She's like, oh my God, I don't think I would ever, you know, have this kind of project ever.
Okay. Hopefully she enjoyed the process. But yeah, it's a type, for me, on the larger kind of context of the question, I think every project is different in a way. So there are projects where it's so exhausting and the style of the project makes you not want to do it again. But that's just in the moment. There, I had a lot of fun on that project, and maybe in a few years I want to do something, I miss it. But right after you finish it, you put yourself out there so much that, yeah, you're like, I'm never doing this again. But I think human beings find themselves jumping into things that they say that they'll never do again, but obviously they found some pleasure in it. So I always do sort of like a different project maybe after one, because I love obviously making films and I love the craft of it and I love the process, but I want to like pivot so then I'm not sort of exhausting myself on one side of my creativity. Mm-hmm. I can just move over to another side that is not so exhausted. And so with Tay Lin's project, it was it's a very ambitious project and a lot of challenges. And so I would look to do projects that are less different challenging challenges. That was a very physical challenge in many ways. And I would never want to put someone like Tay Lin, an artist, like she gave so much to it. It's exhausting for everyone. And so I think it's more thinking about like the amount of physical exertion and stress. And it's not that I never want to make a music video again or music film. I still love it, but not the same type of one. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of directors that I respect, especially in the United Kingdom, that they might direct a film, and then afterwards they direct a play, and then they direct a film. Mm-hmm. And they always make sure that in between is a different type of project. And I think that's like a good way to kind of work where you're still being creative, but again, it's like a totally different side of your creativity.
Mm. Yeah, when you're telling the stories about the whole process of it, I'm just thinking it's unfair to compare writing a book to making a movie, because with books, you can just write yourself. But being a filmmaker is like you have to conduct the whole orchestra. But you've been proving that you're very good at juggling between side. You know, you jump from like working with clients to like artists, and you know, because there's a different type of artist. There's an artist like consider asshole that cannot work with anyone. But you're a type of like you can work with anyone, right? Is that what's the most difficult thing for you to work with people?
Maybe people who are like disrespectful to the crew and the people who are trying to work together with you. I think that's hard to get over. Even when I'm working with a client or a studio, I understand like everyone's trying to do their job at the end of the day. They're not trying to make my job harder. It might seem that way, but at the end of the day, they're
maybe
hoping.
Maybe they do.
And if that's what helps them keep their job, then maybe. But I still try to understand what their mindset is, because it just makes it easier. You always think of like what makes someone human in a way. If someone is like driving in front of you and just like cuts you off all of a sudden, instead of like honking your horn, take like a second to think like, oh, maybe their pregnant wife is in the back seat, about to have labor, and that they need to go somewhere. And so, I mean, I've always been in situations where I might be, you know, rude or like not understanding, but it's because maybe that very specific moment, I try to, you know, utilize that in everything I do, because it just helps me be calmer and less angry towards people. Obviously, you know, it's funny on set. I mean, we've worked on some projects that I've been angry on set. And if I'm ever angry on set, people are always like, oh, Unbow is like very mad at something. There must be something really wrong. So I don't try to use it too much. You know, even in The Greatest Night in Pop, I'm not going to name who, but there's certain artists that are a little more difficult. And if they're rude to the crew, then that's when I defend the crew in a way. Like, don't. You're angry, but don't put it on everyone else. Like, be angry to me, it's fine. Like, we're talking, you can interact with me. But when you're rude to everyone, it's like not legitimate. I always see what I do as such a privilege. Like, I was going to be a lawyer for a long time. And so now to be a filmmaker, to like do what I'm really passionate about, I'm grateful for that. And so that helps me, having that gratitude and not being angry. Of course, again, I'm angry and frustrated sometimes, but it doesn't ever stop me from like understanding the big picture. Like, I might walk away from something like offset just to cool down a bit, but I always come back.
Actually, I know you for a long time, but I didn't know the fact that on the day you're supposed to take the exams to enter the law school, you just decide to stay in your car and did not get out. But before that, I want to ask, you chose a green tea. And if green tea, say something about you, what it is.
You should tell me, what does green tea, you've had many guests, and what's the different drink, what they sipped, what does it say about them?
I know that if you can choose and it's a different time of the day, you would go for the whiskey. What whiskey tell about you then?
Huh? Is there a sponsor that I need to like?
No. No sponsor.
I like Cavalon.
No, I didn't ask
sorry.
The brand.
I was like, what are you asking me for?
Like, what does it say about you?
Oh, that I like whiskey?
Yeah.
It's funny. I try to drink less, but I've been like, you know, this idea of blue zones and people who live for a long time. And one of the things that many old Japanese women do, like the woman who was, she I think recently passed away, but she said she drank like a glass of whiskey every day. And so then I started looking into whiskey. I was like, oh, it used to be like used for medicine in many ways. And so maybe that's my excuse now to drink whiskey. I don't know. Like, it's hard to explain why you like something. It's created over decades of growing up, but I always like the taste of whiskey.
But what the most memorable moment when you drink whiskey?
It's sort of silly moments. I was on a film festival jury and the other jurors, they, you know, they told us, the festival was like, oh, order, when we were deciding which film is going to win, they're like, oh, order whatever you want to drink. And one juror, he saw like an $80 just shot of whiskey, and he ordered that one. And then the other juror is like, we're going to order that one too. And so that's a memorable one. Every time I drink whiskey, it feels like a nice... I mean, maybe I drink a lot of whiskey, so maybe not so
Yeah,
much.
Because I remember there's a time you got... I think you were new to... Were you new to Saigon at that time? But one of the time, one of the trip you made it back to Saigon, and you said, oh, Ming, you should try that the first bar. There's a bunch of whiskey there, right? It's like, that's just how you introduced the bar to me.
Is the first bar still around?
They moved.
Oh, they moved?
To the J-Town, the Chippen Town, but not in that Wing Tuk Kang anymore. But then it's in my mind at that time, it's like an association between bao and whiskey. Of course, you got here with your green tea, not whiskey. Tea, you know, it's different to people. What make you feel, how you feel when you drink tea?
I think I don't drink coffee, you know that. And but I feel like it calms me drinking tea. I don't drink it every day. I don't need the caffeine. But when I do, it's quite a ritual in the morning. Like I think the same way that people make coffee, right? And it just like helps them set the day. I was thinking of drinking whiskey when I walked in, but you weren't going to join me. So I thought I'll just drink tea because I won't drink coffee. So I think it just, yeah, it's just calming for me.
Yeah. Do you drink tea more or whiskey more with your parents?
With my parents? I never drink. Well, maybe with my dad, sometimes I'll drink whiskey, but never. My mom still thinks I don't drink. I don't know. She's going to watch this and... She just, as all parents do, they still think you're, even till the day you die, you're still a baby in many ways. So I mean, I drink red wine with my mom usually. I don't drink tea. I don't usually see them in the morning.
Yeah. One of the lucky thing is sometimes you know the friend and you know their parents too. So I know about parents. And then this one time I remember, and is that in D.C. or it's in New York? But then in U.S., your mom complained that, oh my God, film school is so expensive. That
she complained to you?
Yeah,
oh, she never told me that.
Like, yeah, oh my God, like film school is expensive. How she see you now? Like now she, I think one of the time that she went to watch Saigon Yo in Vietnamese, a Vietnamese movie in US, and now to The Great at Night in Pop in Vietnamese subtitle. How she's, do you think she see you differently? Now you're so big.
I mean, I'm not, I don't know about that, but.
Maybe compared to when she complained about like film school is expensive, maybe now she thinks, oh, it's all worth it.
Well, I don't think like, you know, our parents of a, people of a certain generation have the framework of like what it means to be like a successful Vietnamese American filmmaker, because there weren't that many before, like when I was starting up. And so I don't blame her for me wanting me to be a lawyer, because I think there's a certain level of respect that lawyers and doctors have always displayed, no matter where you're from, right? And I mean, your mom's a doctor.
Yeah.
I think now, luckily, I'm hoping that, yeah, by me being able to have a career as a filmmaker, that younger filmmakers can say, oh, look, you know, Unbow has made a film that was on Netflix. You watch Netflix, so I can be a filmmaker too. That's my hope. I always want to help the next generation with an example somehow. So my film, Greatest Night in Pop, premiered at Sundance. Humorously enough, my parents are divorced from each other. They don't really like seeing each other. And so I had to figure out who's going to go to which premiere. And so I invited my mom to the Sundance premiere. She's a big Lionel Richie fan, and Lionel Richie was there. And Lionel was like, you know, took photos with my mom and invited my mom to his house in Los Angeles. And I think that might help think my
What bigger. Kind of lawyer can do that?
Exactly. And so I think that was a big moment. And even I'm still trying to impress my mom. I think we're always trying to impress our parents just so we don't have to like explain things to them. So on the closing night for HIF for the Ho Chi Minh City International Film Festival, I'm going to take her as my date to the closing night.
Okay.
But some people mistake me for her boyfriend because my mom looks young sometimes. So that's not my girlfriend, everyone.
When you turn into a filmmaker, I think it's that there's a power of telling more stories, right? And I think you mentioned a lot about the complexity of storytelling. When did you have the urge of saying, or do you have the urge at all of telling the story of American Asian, which is represent the whole, such a huge upcoming community?
Yeah. I think I've always wanted stories that just reflect my own experience. And being Asian American, being Vietnamese American, it's because growing up, when I went to the cinema and I would just see life on a big screen. And by seeing something on a big screen, I thought that life was more important. That story was more important because someone took the time to make it a film. Growing up, I didn't see many stories that looked like the stories of my parents, of my family. Psychologically hit me. It's like, oh, maybe white people's stories are more important because that's all I see. And as luckily, you know, as time went on, I get to see more Asian films and films from different cultures. But then it made me understand too, as a young kid, like, oh yeah, black communities have important stories. Asian communities have important stories. But it was very, and maybe that's me being a dreamer thinking what is seen on the big screen. But I think a lot of people still think that way. When they see a story, it makes them think, oh, if you watch a Marvel film, like, it's a superhero story. Mm-hmm. Or if you watch Dune, it just feels like there's something epic about that life. And so that's why I think for me, representation is so important from the Asian American perspective, because it's a time in Hollywood where people are talking about it more. Mm-hmm. And you could either sit back and just listen to the conversation, or you can take action and take opportunity from that, because there's very few opportunities in Hollywood. So you have to be very strategic about it in many ways. And I would say, like, it's funny because when I lived in Vietnam, you don't have that same sense of representation because everyone on screen is Vietnamese, right? And so there's representation is 100%. But I remember talking, I was like teaching a class here, and I asked, and we were talking about representation, Asian American representation. One of the Vietnamese students was like, well, we still look to Hollywood for like these very big stories for films. And she quoted, like, or she remembered, like, one time when she went to go see X-Men Days of Future Past, and Jennifer Lawrence in there.
Say some Vietnamese.
Exactly.
Yeah.
When there's a scene where she speaks Vietnamese, yeah. And these Vietnamese students were like, oh my God, Hollywood is thinking about us. Like, Jennifer Lawrence is speaking Vietnamese, even though the Vietnamese was, yeah, I could not understand what she was saying at all. And so I was like, okay, even if Vietnam is telling their own stories, you know, you still watch the Oscars, you still think about these big films and that are making a lot of money, you know, starting to change, you know, with China, India, Vietnam too, and even Korea, right? People are starting to repivot, like, Hollywood is not the center. It's moving, it's still, like, mm-hmm. a big part of it, but I think, again, I have, like, this responsibility in some ways because I am able to work in Hollywood and I understand Vietnam in some ways that I want to try to bridge the representation between the two sort of like cinema worlds.
Mm-hmm. When you did Be Water with Bruce Lee, how did they choose you?
I chose them.
I just wonder the factor of being American Asian here. Do they believe with that kind of projects, an American Asian will get it better?
I knew I could get it better, to be honest, because all the other films about Bruce Lee that were sort of big were done by white people. And so I think it takes some experience. I'm not saying that only people from that community can tell the story from that community. I think the conversation has swung too much in that way. I think you have to really do the research, right, mm-hmm. first. But because like an Asian American has never really been given the opportunity, that was important. And how do I tell a story about a very famous person in a different way? Bruce Lee, in many ways, for Americans and a lot of people globally, he wasn't even Asian to them. He was just Bruce Lee. Mm-hmm. I think he had to start somewhere. He didn't just was born Bruce Lee and then like he didn't transcend race. He had to fight a lot because of his race early on. And he was one of the rare people who now, because of everything he did, people don't think about his race as much. But it had to start somewhere. So I was very aware, and I thought it was really important to talk about the origin and the journey of him to become, how Bruce became Bruce Lee. I have a very, this collaborator I'm working with who, I won't name her name, but she talks about like coming, she does a lot of films about other cultures. And on the other side of things, you know, she's a white woman, but she says when she comes in, when you come to a place as an outsider, sometimes you see the beauty of a place and of people that people won't even notice already because they've lived it so much. It's part of their daily lives. So they sometimes it takes someone from the outside to see it. And I think that's really mm-hmm. beautiful too. Mm-hmm. It's at the other side of like you have to be of this community to tell a story. But sometimes you're too into the community where you don't understand why this community, why it makes it beautiful.
Let's say you did this version of Bruce Lee. How did you react with the version of a small part of the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood? How did you see that version of Bruce Lee?
Yeah, so Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, I guess it's like a very caricature, cartoonish version of Bruce Lee. I respect artistic freedom and Quentin Tarantino, the directors, but I also think there should be a level of responsibility that he takes on, knowing my problem with that film is like most of the other people who are like based on a true story, he made them very human. Mm-hmm. Even Charles Manson, who murdered all these people, they're like, oh, Charles Manson mm-hmm. is such a human. It's okay. He's not just a crazy killer. But Bruce Lee, they only gave one side of Bruce Lee in that film. And he was just like this very arrogant, cocky guy who mm-hmm. wanted to beat up on Brad Pitt. And so that was my problem. It wasn't the depiction. I think if he showed a more well-rounded, and he doesn't have to, again, this is just my opinion as someone who watched it, and this is his film, but I wish there was a more full version of, mm-hmm. of a person.
Well, you already made it quite clear in some interview that there's a difference between making a documentary and a film, a motion picture. But then when you make documentary, especially about some true story, true people, real people, is that necessary for you to change the whole, like you feel like you know them better after making it?
I mean, I hope so. I think it's important to...
But for you, you experienced that. Every time I did a podcast with people, I'm like, oh my God, I can be best friend with them after. Because you go through something, right? Yeah. So like, I wonder how that process for you. Of course, you enjoy the process of making the movie, but like, for example, you did that late night live
from New York.
Live from New York but that's like a bunch of people, right? It's like a 40. Yeah. But then Bruce Lee is someone is like just the whole movie is about him. So do you get to know, do you feel like you're really knowing the person?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, even it's funny, this conversation we're having. Mm. I mean, we drink and we have long conversations, right? But like, you're obviously asking questions that you wouldn't ask me normally when we're hanging out. And so I'm getting to, I think you know me well enough where you kind of know what I'm going to say, to be honest. This is more for the audience. But I would say most of the projects that I do, I'm not like a huge fan of the subject mm-hmm. immediately. Like, mm-hmm. I like the process of learning with the audience. And the process of making the film is also the process of learning about that subject. Mm. Because I think you can tell when a filmmaker is like a big fan or thinks he or she knows so much about the subject, then you're not asking the right questions. And so even with like Bruce Lee with Be Water, you know, I was coming off of end of a relationship. And I think that actually helped me think about Bruce Lee as a human and his relationships to people. because the film, you know, obviously it's about one person, but we're interviewing people who knew him really well. So it's his relationship to these other people. And one person we interviewed was his ex-girlfriend, Amy Sanbo, who was his first girlfriend in America. She was Asian American. She taught him how to be Asian American because he was still just very Asian when he first came, when, you know, he came back to America and for college. She taught him so much, and he proposed to her, and she said no. And he wouldn't have been the same Bruce Lee if he said yes. He would have probably lived and owned a dry cleaners or something in the middle of America. And so, like, those lessons, I always try to bring them back to what I'm experienced at the moment, because it just, again, you create closeness to the work that you're doing. And you know, I never think, like, to put myself directly into any of my films, but maybe the story and the characters become more personal because they're a relation of what you're going through. There's a writer that I love called Philip Roth, and he makes stories that are like alternate realities, alternate futures, but he has this idea called a false memoir, right? Even though the world is different, mm-hmm. all the characters are like based on his family or his friends. And like, so there's still like a groundedness, a closeness to the characters. And the characters are always the ones usually to like help the emotion of the story. And so I think that's helpful. I always think about that idea of false memoir, even though I'm doing a film about We Are the World. Like, how is it close to me? And how do I make it closer to the characters of the story?
But then which directions do we go? You try to get the emotion out there from different people closer to you, or you get your emotion out to closer to them. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's both, right? Mm-hmm. If you have to feel the emotion that they're portraying, but you have to be curious about that emotion and that journey that they're having because it's something that touches upon you. I think that's how I watch movies, too. I watch a movie, I go in for like a world that is totally different from mine. It has nothing to do, I want to escape from wherever I am. But then when I walk out of that movie, I'm like, oh my God, that felt like my life. That felt like a memory. That felt like my childhood or a relationship. And yeah, you start with something far away and then it gets closer and closer. And so I think about that when I'm making films, when I'm watching films, and it helps me ask better questions. I think you do it too when you're asking questions of someone, right? It's just like you think about like, okay, how do I feel? Cinema is very much a art form of feelings. You know, I think sometimes we try to intellectualize art too much, and we don't think about the feeling when we watch something immediate. Mm-hmm. We don't remember that feeling. We just think like, oh, let's what are the questions, the details and the technical things. And as a filmmaker, I obviously do that, but it's usually the second time I watch a film. The first time, I just want to be like a little kid and just like let everything come at me and then see what comes out of me from that experience. And again, that's how I try to make films too, is like, you know, Greatest Night in Pop is a movie set in the 80s. And I could have made it in a way where it's like very retro of the 80s and like just feels trying to steal ideas from the 80s. But I was like thinking more about like, what is the feeling I get when I watch something from that time of my life, and what I like from watching a heist film, like what the energy is. And I think that makes it more true to the art form and less, again, like thinking too about the brain and things like that.
No, it's funny in a way that when you think of all the art form, all we want to do is, I have this emotion and I want you to feel that emotion. But then we have to create such a granted medium right here. And then you put it there and then you're hoping people take it from there to there. Basically, it's just connections. But when we talk about, you talk about like whole process of you want to learn something new. Do you feel that you learn enough? Let's say you're digging a hole. And when you're like, okay, this is the treasure, I touch it, and then it's time to, you know, to stop. I'm not talking about life. I'm talking about just the project. Like, do you feel like, oh, I have enough? Because let's say do documentary, it's all about doing research, and then you get to know, you have to have the story, right? So how do you know that, okay, this is the story?
I mean, the projects that I've tended to work on, to be honest, are like the stories have already happened and re-sculpt the story into something that can become my own. Other types of documentaries, it's very hard when you're following a story and you don't know when the end is. It's you get very impatient. Those are the films that make me very tired, and it's quite difficult.
You haven't done anything like that?
The problem is, like, the ones that I've done, they're not done yet because I'm waiting. The ability to, like, tell an infinite narrative makes it hard to figure out when you're done. And I think I've realized over time, as a filmmaker, it's hard for me to work that way. I like the idea of sculpting. It's like a metaphor with, like, a piece of clay, right? Like, if you're given, like, one specific piece of clay
to work with that,
then it's manageable. But if people keep on throwing you more clay over on top of each other and you don't know when it's going to stop, it's hard to, like, see what the final thing is. And so I'm almost working backwards, where I see the piece of clay and I know exactly what I want and what I need to do in order to sculpt it to what I want. And it's a different type of filmmaking. It's not, like, better or worse. I think I appreciate films that can follow someone for a long time, but it's just, it's a different process.
Yeah. If you go back and then choose any kind of project to do, would you stick with the style of, like, oh, at this much of clay, or you would be just all over the, you know, if you can choose, like, at one point you'd, like, done all the projects that you like? And
I mean, to be honest, there's some, again, directors who want to brainstorm their own project from nothing. I work better when someone presents me with an idea or something that they don't think is a film. I'm like, oh, I can imagine that as a film. One of my favorite directors is Stanley Kubrick, and I spent some time in London and got to see his archives for a bit, and I realized all his films are adaptations. Nothing he made was, like, original, really. And in his journal, he talks about when someone presents him an idea or he's reading, like, a book. When reading, that's when his creativity and his imagination is inspired. And that's how I feel too. It's like, give me a sentence and then I can imagine a whole film out of it. Don't ask me to write the sentence from the start. And again, this is different approaches to creativity and filmmaking. There's no right or wrong. Give me different pieces of clay, give me a piece of glass and tell me to make something out of it. I think that inspires me more. I call it the tyranny of choice. I think now there's, in every world, from dating apps to streaming platforms, we're given so many choice and you're scrolling forever for this choice. You think you're trying to find the perfect thing because you're given so many options. Give me four things and I will make something imperfect out of it. But maybe for me, it's my idea of perfection. I think that's how I work better as an artist. And, like, oh, make any film you want. Like, that is much more challenging for me.
Remember the very first script that you wanted to make a movie that you gave it to me to read?
Oh, I don't remember. Oh gosh, what was it?
It's like 12 years ago, 13 years ago. It's about the Vietnamese girl will go to US and...
Oh, jet lag.
Would you ever wanted to make that movie again?
I need to reread the script, to be honest, and I think that's a process of writing that I enjoy. Is, like, you know, when you should write something, or for my process, is, like, write something without reading it. Just write as much as you can, and then later on, come back to the project so you're reading it as a reader instead of the writer. Because then you know, like, oh, this is... If you're in the process of it, you're, like, constantly thinking about it and you don't have the distance. And even with films, I do the same thing where I like to, you know, finish a cut and then step away for, like, a month and come back to it and rewatch it, because you have enough distance to watch it as a viewer and not someone who created it. And I think that's important. And so I'm very scared to read Jet Lag again. I was a very different person, different filmmaker at the time. But I think now, like, with the journey and experience of learning and growing, hopefully, then maybe I can remember that Bao who really wanted to tell that story and combine it with the, you know, the Bao right now. Mm-hmm. The Bao right now.
Yeah. Bao right now.
Wow, sometime, I don't know, even the greatest filmmakers or storyteller, all they want is to tell their own story. That very first script based on a love story, some interested in love. How you see love these days with the Bao right now version?
The Bao right now version of love. I it's hard to answer like in this moment.
For the audience, or it's like, I'm sure if I ask you over a whiskey glass, then it's not going to be a problem. It's not going to be like, oh, it's so hard to answer.
You're asking like a very broad question, though. Usually over whiskey,
really?
You're like,
oh, really?
Specific questions.
Really?
You can be more specific if you want. If you want, yeah.
Well, I think it's very consistent to what we've been talking about. It's like always see, you know, it can be a broad story. It can be a bunch of stranger stories, but then it's always go back to your own emotions and your own feeling. And you use that lens to tell other people's story. So very first script, you mentioned it's a love story, and that's a real love right there in that script. And you mentioned the Bao version right now. And how you see love, and then how you, is in there any projects like reflect the definition of love about right now?
Well, I can just imagine if I reread Jetlag, that script, it would be very romantic mm-hmm. version of love and hopeless in mm-hmm. many ways. I think if I was to rewrite it with who I think I am today, it would be a little more practical, mm-hmm. less romantic. I mean, less, still with a sense of romance, but not hopelessly romantic. Because over, and you've witnessed a lot of my relationships, I think for a long time, I followed like this very cinematic and version of romance and love. It's like, oh, there's only one mm-hmm. person for you in the universe, and realizing like, there's many different ones, or not. And by the one, it used to think like, oh, that has to be a perfect relationship. And so now I think I lean in more on the imperfections and understand, like, just going back to your question, it might seem random, but like when you're talking about like, oh, when you're working with the artist, like how do you understand, like, mm-hmm. I'm not looking, and this is a cliche, it's like finding the perfection in the imperfection in many ways. Even with my own life, you know, before I was like very curated and planned things. And now I think after the pandemic, to be honest, when everyone lost control over their lives because of something, I was like, I have really no control over things. And trying not to control relationships or partners or myself in a relationship, just like letting myself learn from it. I think you witnessed me changing in my art and the way that I talk to people and connect with people, that I'm less, there's still, you can never hide who you are, like there's always that sense of me, but I think I'm more aware of it now, and it doesn't overpower how I view a partner, how I enter a relationship. It doesn't have to be perfect, it doesn't have to be like the perfect wedding, the perfect marriage, the perfect home, all that. Like I almost feel like, oh, it's perfect because it's imperfect again. Like I appreciate that it's imperfect, like the wabi-sabi of life mm-hmm, in many ways. Mm. I used to like maintain all my things. It has to, like, my camera has to be in perfect condition, and then I get stressed out if it was imperfect. But now it's like, oh, it's imperfect because maybe I traveled somewhere, and then it's part of the experience, part of the scars that you leave mm-hmm. yourself.
Mm-hmm. And it's at the end, is it all about like enjoy the process, right? It's like, I guess relationships are the same.
Yeah, and I think, you know, going back to like talking about what you learn in a film, like Be Water. Bruce Lee's philosophy in life actually helped me a lot, like just being water, mm-hmm. like, and understanding, like, you know, water can be hard, water can be soft, and you mm-hmm. have to like go with the flow. And that I try to take away a lot of things from each film that I learn, and even with Greatest Night in Pop, like the biggest artists of their generation, they were just like nervous and around each other. And like, it's okay to be nervous, and sometimes that inspires people more. And so, I think in my relationships too, like learning from each relationship, I used to think like Sometimes I might be so heartbroken that I want to go back to the bow before the relationship. And some of the best advice that I got was like, no, that relationship was important to becoming who you are today. Like, don't try to be like, forget about that. Like, really learn from the joy and the love and the heartbreak. Like, you grew out of that into something who you are today, and not trying to go back to an older version of yourself.
Are you healed?
Healed is a good word, because I think before I was looking to be cured of things, cured of heartbreak. And I think heal too is assume like there is never going to be wounds. I'm in the process of healing until the day I die, I think. And that is important. There's no like absolute for me. Like I lean on the idea of being, of healing instead of, like there's a difference between saying you're a complete person mm-hmm. versus being a whole person, like whole, right? And so I try to think about that more, where it's not like, again, I'm arriving, I will be healed because I don't think like this anymore. Because there's good days and bad days for everyone. And so I always think I'm in the process of healing myself. And that helps me a lot more than thinking like, oh,
yeah.
I'm waiting for that day. Yeah. It's done. Let's celebrate.
Yeah, I'll share that with you. You know, it's a lot of things. I guess it's where we sympathize for each other as well. It's like, yeah, everything's in the process. That's why I want to nail our interview to go back to that American Asian representation. It's a wave right now. It's a movement right now. And I think you've seen this from the start. But for me, it's the way I look at it, it's like, you know, when I start my career and everything, everyone talking about being a feminist. I'm just thinking it's just more like a movement, and it's only settled when it's normalized everything. So you think it's happened the same with the American Asian community? Like, at one point, story are just stories. Like, good stories are good story. It's not because of, oh, they are Asian. Do you think, I don't know if that makes sense to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think about it the same way I think about why I like to celebrate birthdays or holidays. People might say like, oh, I don't celebrate International Women's Day because every day should be Women's Day, right? But I think in your life, if you don't take a step back to reflect on why this day, because you can say you treat women with respect every day, but you don't understand why you do that mm-hmm. in a way
yeah.
and why it's important to do that. And so the same way you're celebrating a birthday too, it's like, it's a moment to have a sip and reflect back and take a break from life and understand like why, what do you want to do this year in mm-hmm. your life? Who do you want to spend time with? It seems like a very different subject, but with representation, you take a step back and realize why is it important to have an Asian American story? Why is it important to have an Asian American filmmaker tell that story? When you're in the process of it, you don't think about it as much. But I think if you don't stop back and meditate on things and let things breathe, then you go through life without having the sense of meaning and purpose mm-hmm. and understanding why you do things. Mm-hmm. I think our culture and society are so obsessed with the how of things and less about the why of things. And so I think when you can take a step back and understand why you do things, it gives meaning. And I mm-hmm. think for me, I'd love to find meaning in things.
Mm-hmm. So we need to be everything before we being water, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. If you go to a desert island tomorrow and don't know when you can come back, which book you bring?
Is this a typical one question?
Book. Yeah, typical. But if book. I don't ask it, then I have problem with my audience.
Oh, really?
And then they show that, TikTok shop show that, whatever my guest book name is, it boosts selling.
Yeah, okay.
No, don't think too much.
Okay,
it's like
I'm
thinking
not,
about the movie, and then here's the brief, and then here's the...
I mean, I think like a book that has touched me more than any other book recently is On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous. It's the book that comes to mind just instinctually from that question. It's just like something that's moved me so much. It's to be honest, like crying in a book is a little hard for me, but I was just like weeping reading that book to feel all the emotions and remind myself when I first read it how it felt. I think it's a book that you know, it reflected a lot of what I thought was similar to my own upbringing. So talking about Asian American representation, it just felt like there's more meaning and you know, for better or for worse, because like a wider audience also accepted that book, it gave meaning to that story and that experience in a way I think like not a lot of other projects have done. And so that's something I probably bring on a desert island.
Cho mọi người nhé, cuốn này đã dịch sang tiếng Việt mà cũng dịch rất là hay so với cái bản đầu có cái cuốn sách đầu tiên của Ocean Vương xuất bản ở Việt Nam thì cái bản dịch nó không tốt lắm.
Oh, really?
The very first book, yeah, okay. I didn't enjoy that. Nhưng cái cuốn sách này ở Việt Nam dịch là Một Thoáng Ta Rực Rỡ Ở Nhân Gian của tác giả Ocean Vương, and thanks to you actually I got a chance to interview him. And then quite in a very special moment because his mom passed away and then he was about to publish the book after, Time as a Mother. And thanks to you that I got the email and everything and got to talk to him. Yeah, that's a great book to bring to the island. And then if people, you haven't read that one, make sure you do, because it's sold out right when it's got out in Vietnam, it's sold out right away. It's funny about this interview. Because there's been all those years I never interviewed Bao, and then I cannot put my mindset to be an interviewer, and plus in English is not my, it used to be my strength, it's not my strength anymore. Like there's so much things I wanted to ask or just get from you a better sense. I'm sure when I rewatched this interview, I would, you know,
if you want to ask me something in Vietnamese, then I can answer in English though.
Okay. I can ask this. I just don't know if I should ask it. For me, knowing you all those years, I always have this feeling that you're too nice to become the greatest artist. It's not that I wish you more broken because you've been broken enough, but then I wished I see more extreme side of you. Even when I watched The Greatest Nine Pop, I'm still thinking, oh, it's this kind of, it's very bad. But I want to see something that would surprise me. Like, you do everything perfectly, and like, you kind of, it's like perfect, but it's missing the imperfect.
Is there a question in there?
It's not a question.
I mean, we could talk about the discussion.
I just throw it out there for
yeah,
you.
Yeah, no, I mean, you see how it reflects me, though, which I appreciate you saying. That's like it reflects who I am, and maybe like in this stage of my life, I'm like embracing the imperfection more. So that the future projects, you'll see that imperfection. But I think when I was making these previous projects, I was still again in the process of like unraveling this idea of perfect everything, and I want to make sure it's like very authentic too. And so like everything I've done is part of me, but I still hope I'm in the very early stages of my career. I want to do this for the rest of my life, and this, you know, from this conversation, which I really love, is just like, yeah, I don't get to talk about these things. And when you get to talk about these things, you realize when you're asked a question, and I think asking a question, and you've been doing it for so long, is like so important, right? I think a good question is better than a good answer in many ways. And so it makes you think when you're receiving a great question, a generous question, you think about your life and you think about your approach to life and art in a different way. And again, it's the idea of like reflecting back. It's like, you know me. It's until you ask me that question that I can think back about it. That idea of taking a breath, having a sip, and realizing like why I did these things and not just the how of doing things. For me, there's a lot of imperfection in Greatest Night in Pop. But I think, yeah, again, maybe in the work that I do in the future through... I mean, Be Water to me has like some... It's more of a practice in poetry, that film, than Greatest Night in Pop. That was more precise because I was coming out of a heartbreak, and so I think I put myself more emotionally. That for me, that's a more emotional film than Greatest Night in Pop. Greatest Night in Pop is a emotion of joy and less of like struggle. Like Greatest Night in Pop is not a film about struggle. It's a film about vulnerability. It's a film about inspiration and music. But like Bee Water is like this guy who gets hit, you know, so many ways, but decides to pick himself up, and tragically, right when he feels like he's reached the top, he passes away. And again, that film came in the middle of heartbreak, and so I think that was what made it emotional. And who knows where I will be in the process of my next film. I don't want to have to go through heartbreak to make a better film. And it's interesting when you say I'm too nice.
I apologize for not watching Bee Water yet.
You still haven't watched Bee Water?
I haven't watched it.
Oh, so it's hard to watch. I'll send you the link.
Yeah, I know. Like well, that's
you'll
why
have
maybe
me
I,
back on
yeah,
to the show.
Yeah,
okay,
yeah,
then
but
you'll
then
get
that's
see,
why
yeah.
I'm thinking you're too nice. Maybe if I watch it. You're yeah. not that nice anymore.
Yeah, it's different. Bad
no, I know, I know, I know. No, but here's the thing. I get it. Who am I to say? I say things to actually provoke people to say whatever. I don't think good questions is more important than good answer. I think good questions cannot guarantee good answer. But a good answer is all going to guarantee that, oh, whatever you asked before it seemed good because the good answer. And I think that your answer is about, I think it's most important things to be authentic about yourself. As long as you feel that it's true to yourself at that moment, who cares if you're too nice or not nice?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. I was like, that's who I am, right?
So yeah, it's not, that's who you are.
It's like, I can't change that, and I won't change it to make better art. Or I think the art, whatever I am in that moment, is what is as much of me as possibly can be.
And who am I? I'm just like one person. I you know, have a different test and things, and then I would project that to you because I'm an interviewer. But, you know, at the end, it's about, I think it's all about the emotions that your work could be done, and then the story that you tell. And I would remember, you know, it's funny, that night in New York, we like, oh, Bao is coming to New York tomorrow. Let's all watch the Greatest Night in Pop. Then at least we can talk to him about it. So this becomes such a very, you know, a nice moment between us as a group of friends gathering from everywhere, be in New York and watch that movie. You would never know about that.
Yeah, I'm glad movie. You watched it before I arrived, because I would have been very mad. Just kidding.
And what's next for you?
What's next? Making imperfect films, maybe. Mm-hmm. I am working on a feature, like scripted film at the moment. I have a couple documentaries coming out with, and then still working with East Films to try to do more projects in Vietnam as well. I don't love to talk about specifics until things are done.
Yeah,
I know.
I know.
So I get a bit superstitious about it.
Okay.
But yeah, I'm excited to be doing what
yeah,
I do.
Yeah,
Bao
is always this like kind of like secret agent, like meet you anywhere in the world and then like, what you working on? No, I cannot tell you. It's confidential. And okay, I'm used to it.
Okay.
But I know that you always just, you know, quote, keep working on. I think you're one of the hardest working I've seen. I know you don't like to watch your old project, but if you have to choose one project, maybe in the future you can do so much more, but if you choose just one project to ever go back and watch it, like it's your legacy, it's there yet.
I was like, you should watch Bee Water, but yeah, I think Bee Water for me is, I haven't seen it in a while, so it'd be interesting, again, to rewatch it at the stage that I am in at the moment. But yeah, I would say Bee Water, because of where I was then and knowing it's a very important story, and I felt like a large weight on my shoulders doing a film about Bruce Lee, arguably the most famous Asian person in the world ever, right? And so I took that responsibility as like a privilege that, oh, I'm given the opportunity to tell this story. Like, first, I don't want to mess it up, but I wouldn't change a thing about that film. Like, it was what I wanted to do, and I don't walk away like saying, oh, I'd do this and that. And so for now, at this moment, I would say be water.
Okay. Thank you very much. How you feel?
Great. Yeah. It's easy.
The same.
So
it's the same, right?
Same as what?
Same as what we talk normally.
Yeah. You don't ask me about my dating life, which is good. I mean, you kind of ask. Just, yeah.
I just don't know if my audience cares.
Perfect. Yeah.
But, you know, yeah, good luck. I don't know you need it, but...
I always take good luck from a lucky person.
No, but in your, you know, it's like everyone have this friend that you know for a long time, and then it just get bigger and bigger. And then it's like, you know, and one day you would just see whatever news about him, and like, oh, that's my friend. So Bao's to me is like that. And I cannot believe that I wait for 12 years to... finally interview you. So thank you so much. Well,
thank you for having me.
Yeah.
It's an honor. Well, let's not wait for 12 years for the next one,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Right, let's wait for the next one then. Thank you so much. And thank you. Cảm ơn mọi người đã lắng nghe. Bảo như Thùy Minh đã nói ngay từ đầu là một nhân vật rất là đặc biệt với Thùy Minh. Đến mức độ mình nghĩ là interview is a little bit cringy for me.
Conversation, maybe?
Yeah. I mean, I would... When doing interview, I have my own, you know, nervous and, you know, it's prepared. But, you know, us is like, we can say whatever. So thank you for bearing this with us. Xin chào, hẹn gặp lại tất cả mọi người ở những cái tập tiếp theo của Have a Sip. Cảm ơn Bảo. Bảo nói gì tiếng Việt đi, Bảo.
Câu gì mới? Câu gì mới?
Câu gì mới hơn là câu nóng quá?
Không nóng quá.
No! Something more romantic,
more
poetry.
Next time. No,
nothing? No, okay.
Yeah, you should ask me to prepare more.
Okay.
This is my imperfect, yeah.
Okay, fine. Be yourself.
Okay.
Be water, là gì?
In tiếng Việt. Something nước.
Oh, there's a lot of things with water for you. You do nước as well. You do, yeah. Do the water with Nguyễn Võ Nghiêm Minh. Như là nước.
Như là nước. Okay, thank you for teaching. Như là nước. That's how I'll end all my interviews.
Yeah.
Như là nước.
No, don't.
Okay, never mind.
Cảm ơn mọi người. Xin chào.